This is number 0080, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0080. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet creator and executive producer Nick Santora of the new television series that he has on A&E called Breakout Kings. What's the show about?
This is a team of cops and convicts. Basically, two U.S. Marshals who don't get along that well pull out of prison three of the hardest fugitives they've ever chased. And they basically tell them, you're going to spend the rest of your sentence in a minimum security prison, much nicer than your current accommodations. And for every runner you help us catch, you get a month off your sentence. And if any one of you is thinking of running, by the way, you go back to prison, sentence is doubled, all three of you. So if one of you runs, you all go back to prison double time.
Broadcaster and professor Hillary McLeod is the author of Revenge of the Lobster Lover. Has she always wanted to write a novel?
Writing is something I've done since I was 5 years old, and it's why I landed in radio quite by accident. I was looking for a job for a writer and landed up copywriting. This is the first time I sat down with the full intent of writing a novel based on my asking myself, what will you regret you never did? And there was only one answer.
And Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and it's only rock and roll on this edition of Book Banter as I review Keith Richards' memoir, Life, as well as take a glance at a couple of the other Rolling Stones-rated books. So get ready to start me up shortly on the Stuff File program.
And, of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0080, is freelance video journalist Mark Doucette. He is also the husband of roller derby queen Alyssa Quasney, better known as Georgia W. Tush, and the owner of the store Neon Skates. You can check her out and her store at the site skateneon.com. And thank you very much, Mark, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the Stuff File news, shall we? We start off with a story from across the pond in the UK. A specialist ice cream parlor plans to serve up breast milk ice cream and says people should think of it as an organic free-range treat. Well, don't we all? The breast milk concoction called the Baby Gaga is available at the Ice Creamist restaurant in London's Covent Garden. Ice Creamist's founder, Matt O'Connor, is confident his take on the miracle of motherhood is going to be a hit. It's priced at a hefty £14, that's about $23 US, a serving. The breast milk was provided by mothers who answered an advertisement online on the online mothers forum Mumsnet. Victoria Hilly, who is 35 from London, was one of 15 women who donated milk to the restaurant after seeing the advert. Hilly works with women who have problems breastfeeding their babies. She says that she believes that if adults realize how tasty breast milk actually is, then new members would be more willing to breastfeed their own newborns. The Baby Gaga recipe blends breast milk with Madagascan vanilla pods and lemon zest, which is then churned into ice cream. O'Connor said the Baby Gaga is just one of a dozen radical new flavors that you'll find at the shop. I'm almost afraid to ask what the others might be. Okay, on to Naples, Florida. That's Naples, Florida. Police say a brawl between roommates over Girl Guide cookies led to assault charges against one of them. The Collier County Sheriff's Office reported that 31-year-old Hersha Howard woke up her roommate early Sunday and accused her of eating her Thin Mints. They argued, and deputies say that it turned physical, with Howard chasing her roommate with scissors. And you know you really shouldn't run with scissors. And hitting her repeatedly with a board and then a sign. Police say the roommate's husband tried to separate them. The roommate said she gave the cookies to Howard's children. Howard is charged with aggravated battery with a deadly weapon and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. She was released on $10,000 bail. Okay, I tend to think that Girl Guide cookies are kind of good, but it's not worth running through the house with scissors over, is it? Well, might be a while before Hersha gets another box of Thin Mints, if you know what I mean. Okay, I have to start off this next story by talking about my other job and also by mentioning the fact that I've never had any trouble with the law and I am not a wanted person. I bring this up because my other job is that of being a television news anchor at Global News here in Montreal. Now, being a TV anchor, one has to naturally expect to be recognized from time to time by the public. That alone is enough to keep me on the straight and narrow, so here's your pro tip of the week. If you're wanted by the police and have been on the run from the law for 10 years, it's probably best to not accept a job as a TV anchorman. I'm just saying. Looks like ego won out over common sense in Romania after 35-year-old Viorel Pleskin took a job as a TV newsperson and amazingly was almost immediately recognized by police and arrested. Pleskin went on the lam in 2001 and managed to escape capture by getting married abroad and then adopting his wife's name to become Viorel Andrei. He had been wanted on check fraud charges. He'll now get to serve 8 years in prison for the conviction that he got back in 2001. In addition, he'll get to face new charges of using a false identity. Wow, 8 years in jail. That's a place where the anchor term, this just in, has a whole different meaning. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest, a Mexican teenager has found an interesting way to get attention and possibly an invite to the wedding of Prince William and Kate Middleton. 19-year-old Estebales Chavez has gone on a hunger strike, saying she won't eat anything until she's invited. Camping out in a blue tent outside the British Embassy in Mexico City, Chavez says she hasn't eaten in over a week. On a flyer, she wrote, "Are they going to let me die just because they won't give me an invitation to the royal wedding? This is my only dream." Wearing braces, pigtails, and glasses, Miss Chavez said the late Princess Diana inspired her campaign, explaining, "I think she was one of the most interesting women in history and one of the best and most beautiful. My mother was a big fan of Lady Di, too, and she died when I was born, so I promised myself I would attend her son's wedding." Yeah, okay. Call me heartless, but I've said this time and time again on the radio and on television. I don't understand the concept of a hunger strike. It's the adult equivalent of a child saying if it doesn't get its own way, they're going to hold their breath. I have absolutely no compassion for anyone who goes on a hunger strike, regardless of how noble their cause is. And let's be clear, this particular cause ain't that noble. Tell me you're going on a hunger strike, and I will sit in front of you and lovingly eat a multiple-course meal. Yes, I know it's cold, but that's just the kind of guy I am. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Nick Santora is one of the creators and executive producers of Breakout Kings, which is a new procedural drama that is about to hit the airwaves on A&E on Sunday, March the 6th at 10 p.m. Now, this show has taken an interesting path on its way to the small screen, and joining us on the program to tell us about it is Nick Santora. Hi, Nick.
How are you?
I'm fine, sir. Thanks for being on the program with us.
What? I'm like a veteran of your show now. What is this, third time, fourth time?
How about that? Well, you were on the old incarnation of the show. Yes, but you are a veteran of being on the program with me. We spoke, I guess, in Law and Order days, and
when my novel
and when
came
your novel
out,
came
I
out,
think.
Yes.
And we talked a lot of Prison Break, too. It's always good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, too. Now, you have this show, speaking of Prison Break, which was a big hit for Fox, you had a show that you were planning to put on Fox, and it didn't work out, but it seems to have found the pilot new life with A&E. That's a rarity. How did this story happen?
Yeah, it is rare. My agent Ari Greenberg told me that he thinks he knows this business inside and out. His dad was a veteran of the business, so Ari knows everything about the history of of Hollywood, and he said he thinks it's happened twice in the past 30, 35 years, Breakout Kings being the second time. Basically, we had my partner, Matt Olmsted, and I, we partnered on this show, and we pitched the idea to Fox Network, and they said, absolutely, we would love to have it, and so we made the pilot for Fox. And then the pilot tested through the roof. It did really well. I think it was the highest testing pilot for 20th that year, but it tested very, very well. And Fox decided that it wasn't right for their schedule. They had other shows they had developed that they wanted to pick up, and they had other shows on their network that they wanted to bring back. And we were just without a home. And when I say 99% of the time, that's less than the percentage. It's 99.99999% of the time. That's it. Your pilot's dead. What you spent the past year of your life working on is just dead. And I went off and took a job at ABC Studios working on the Criminal Minds spinoff, Criminal Minds Suspect Behavior. Matt went off and started working on Terra Nova, which is a dinosaur time travel show that's being executive produced by Peter Chernin, Steven Spielberg. And we just figured it was over. And then a few weeks later, A&E called up and said, we saw this pilot. We love it. And we want to put this show on our network. And we were shocked because that just never happens.
How does something even get out in that regard? Because you would think to a certain degree, if a network doesn't want a pilot, the pilot doesn't see the light of day either on the television screen or amongst executives at other networks.
Yeah, and you're right, Peter. And that's normally how it works. Everyone says every year when a pilot gets passed on, oh, we're going to shop it around and see if someone wants it. But no one ever does. But this show, you know, not to toot our own horn, but this show was good. And we knew it was good. And our agents knew it was good. And the studio knew it was good. And it tested so incredibly high. And they knew there was a chance. So they shopped it, our agents and Peter Chernin, who's a producer on the project, made a million phone calls and got it out there. And we had a few networks that were actually interested in it. But A&E just loved it. Bob DiPetetto, who's the head of A&E, actually called my agents and Matt's agents and said, what's the catch? He's like, I just watched this thing. I loved it. What's the catch? And he figured there must have been something wrong with the pilot or with the production or something else, that there was something he wasn't seeing. And they just said, no, it's just available. And A&E couldn't believe it. We couldn't believe we had a home. They couldn't believe they had an opportunity to do the show with us. It was really a marriage of a show that needed a network and a network that wanted a particular show, and it just played out perfectly. And we're thrilled to be on that network.
Okay, the big difference, though, is you had pitched a television show for the Fox Television Network, one of the Big Four, and with the Big Four comes big budgets. Not necessarily the same thing with A&E.
Well, no, I mean, there's definitely you're absolutely right, there's definitely a different financial model for cable. But we were able to make it work without sacrificing any quality in the show. In fact, I dare people to look at the shows, the episodes that we did for this full season, and say that can't be a network show. I mean, we've got insane action pieces, car chases, explosions, shootouts. I mean, big budget stuff. I can give you a million reasons why it was still able to be pulled off at a budget that was a little less. But I'd say the main one is a gentleman named Ed Milkovich, who was our line producer in Toronto, who basically didn't sleep for 9 months and came up with a million different creative ways to do things on a budget, but that still looked fantastic. The studio kicked in more money when it was necessary. A&E kicked in some more money when it was necessary. Everyone was a partner on this thing. And the show just looks great. So and by the way, it was a great learning experience. I have always done network shows, whether they be on, I've done shows, my gosh, I've been involved with shows that have aired on HBO, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, the CW, I mean, everywhere. I don't believe I've ever done cable. And so it was a learning experience for me. And I don't believe Matt's ever done cable, too. And we just, you know, figured out ways to do things and tell stories more concisely and film in 7 days as opposed to 8 days. And it worked out. Thank goodness.
Okay, so you've whet our appetite with how exciting this show is to get on to the small screen. Tell us what Breakout Kings is about.
Breakout Kings is not your typical cop show. It's about the chasing of the recently escaped, but it's not one of these earnest shows where you have a bunch of cops or a bunch of U.S. Marshals who are all in lockstep saying, we've got to catch the bad guys because they're just so bad, and we need to catch them because bad guys shouldn't be out there because bad guys do bad things, and we're earnest, and we love our jobs. No, this is a team of cops and convicts, because the U.S. Marshals, and we brought in an expert and we did our research, and we heard repeatedly that they very often, not only marshals, lots of law enforcement officers, will go to prisons and talk to people, prisoners, and say, hey, when you escaped, before we caught you, you were running down by the border, or you were in this coastal town or near this coastal town trying to get a boat over to Canada, or what have you. How'd you do it? What did you know? Are there people there that'll help? What's the underground situation like? Whatever it is. And they'd get information. In exchange for that, those prisoners would get a little bit more visitation time or a softer pillow in their cell or a TV or sometimes some time taken off their sentence for cooperating. And we figured we would just take the concept of the show one step further and formalize that arrangement where basically two U.S. Marshals who don't get along that well pull out of prison three of the hardest fugitives they've ever chased. And they basically tell them, you're going to spend the rest of your sentence in a minimum security prison, much nicer than your current accommodations. And for every runner you help us catch, you get a month off your sentence. And if any one of you is thinking of running, by the way, you go back to prison, sentence is doubled, all three of you. So if one of you runs, you all go back to prison double time. So there's a checks and balances there where they watch each other. But there's always that constant threat that one of them might run. So now you have guys who are really just doing it for selfish reasons, but they find themselves sometimes getting their heartstrings pulled on particular cases. The theme of the show is everyone's running from something. And all of these convicts have something in their past, and the cops as well, that they're running from. So it's really not a straight procedural show. Every episode is standalone, but the characters are very important. Where other procedural shows, it's just case of the week, and the dialogue and the characters are almost interchangeable, not Breakout Kings.
That's a great pitch. Now I want to watch it.
Please do, and get a few million of your friends.
Breakout Kings is going to be on A&E. The premiere is on Sunday, March the 6th. Now, with the idea that you're doing this show on cable, you don't have as many episodes as you would have in a season run, correct?
That's right. A full cable season is 13 episodes, and we have 13 episodes, as you said, starting Sunday, March 6th, A&E at 10 p.m., Sundays, 10 p.m. on A&E, and the 13-episode structure is really nice. I really like it because sometimes, especially on Prison Break, we found it, man, when we were doing Prison Break, doing 22 episodes a season. In the last season, we did 24, and keeping those storylines going can be hard. 13 episodes, man, before you know it, you break a few episodes, you're a quarter way done with the season.
I look forward to watching it. Sounds like it's a lot of fun, and it certainly is. Even though you had nothing to redeem yourself for, certainly a redemption situation going from dead pilot to new network. Congratulations, since it's such a rare situation. Looking forward to seeing Breakout Kings, which is on Sunday, March the 6th, rather, on A&E. And I thank you very much, Nick, for being on the program with us.
Peter, thanks for having me on. I love doing your show. Thank you.
Nick Santora, one of the executive producers and creators of the television series Breakout Kings. It premieres on A&E on Sunday, March the 6th at 10 p.m.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet Hillary McLeod, author of Revenge of the Lobster Lover. And another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nelman comes your way as well. Plus, of course, we have lots more stuff and an idiot of the day. And more stuff right here, right now. You know, most countries dream of sending a man to the moon. The United States, of course, have already done it. We here in Canada have more simple goals. There's a group of space buffs who want to make a hockey puck boldly go where no hockey puck has gone before. The Vancouver group is one of 29 teams from 17 countries competing in the latest race to the moon, the Google Lunar X Prize, an effort funded by the web giant to encourage commercial space development. Teams on 4 continents are trying to land a spacecraft on the lunar surface before the end of 2015 in order to win a chunk of the $30 million in prize money. The goal of competitors is to send a robot to the moon, which travels at least 500 meters and transmits video, images, and data back to Earth. The Canadian group, called Plan B, also want to put a hockey puck on the lunar surface to honor their beloved team, the Vancouver Canucks. Now, if they succeed, we can then change that old chestnut of a line that goes, you know, they can put a man on the moon, but, and you can fill in the rest, right? But now, if these guys succeed, we can then say, well, you know, they could put a hockey puck on the moon, yet the Toronto Maple Leafs still can't win a Stanley Cup. Oh, man, being able to say that puts a smile on my face, I tell you. Anyway, moving right along. In Chattanooga, Tennessee, a 26-year-old man is dead after being accidentally bitten by a copperhead snake. We say accidentally because a friend had caught the snake and taken it to the dead guy's house because, for some reason, he wanted his friend to ascertain the snake's gender. And then things went horribly wrong. You know, snakes don't kill friends. Idiots with snakes kill friends. Elsewhere in news, in Warren, Ohio, a 31-year-old man entered a 7-Eleven with a blue bandana over his face and asked the female clerk for a pack of Marlboro Reds. When she told him that that pack would cost $6, he responded, the king doesn't pay for cigarettes. So she began to argue with his highness, which prompted the king to jump over the counter in an attempt to wrestle the pack from the woman. But the king proved no match for the lady clerk, and he fled empty-handed before officers found him about a half mile away and were forced to taser him to subdue him. The king will now face charges of strong-armed robbery and resisting and obstructing police. The robbery charge alone carries a penalty of up to 15 years in prison. In other words, the king just royally screwed himself. Sandra Lean Bathke, age 70, was behind on her rent and was about to be evicted. She asked her landlord's son, Luke Evan Wiemert, 26, for a ride to the Elysian State Bank in Elysian, Minnesota, to get some money. Unfortunately, Bathke's withdrawal was not quite legal, as she allegedly placed a bag on the counter, told the teller she had a gun, and asked her to give her all the money in the drawer. She then thanked the teller, went back to the car, and Wiemert drove away, slowly because of slippery roads, plus he had no idea what just had happened. He didn't even know they were being followed by a witness until he parked in Bathke's driveway and an officer ordered them onto the ground. As they were surrounded, Bathke told the man, "I'm so sorry, Luke." Wiemert's car was easy to follow. According to an investigator, robbing a bank with a Jaguar kind of sticks out. As opposed to, I guess, a little old lady bank robber with a young male getaway driver? That doesn't stick out either? Anyway. Sticking with the old lady theme, in Port Charlotte, Florida, authorities arrested four women, including 70-year-old Elaine F. Pizikowitz, on prostitution charges following a raid at the Mandela Health Spa. Whoa, grandma's a hoe. Acting on a tip, undercover sheriff's deputies began surveillance at the spa where they discovered the ladies had received compensation for sexual acts within the business on numerous occasions. Included in the arrest was 37-year-old Anne-Marie McPeak, the operator of the business where a client pays a door fee to enter. Grandma Elaine has worked at the spa for 4 months and has a state massage license in her name. All four women were taken to the Charlotte County Jail, where they later posted bail. Seriously, there are guys out there who will pay for it with a 70-year-old? Rock on, Grandma. Rock on. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest, the driver of a vehicle involved in a hit-and-run accident claimed that it wasn't him driving the car. His alibi, he was on what he called a random hookup, a date with a woman he had just met in a bar. The car is registered to his wife, who told police that he did have her car at the time. Richard Hartquist, a North Andover, Massachusetts attorney, claimed that the car had been stolen but never reported it. Investigators apparently didn't believe Hartquist's story. He was charged with leaving the scene of an accident involving personal injury, obstruction of justice, and driving with an expired license. And yes, they always seem to have an expired license in these stories. Hartquist is now looking for a new career, a new auto insurance policy, and I'm guessing also a new wife. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Hillary McLeod is a broadcaster and professor who has written a mystery. It's called Revenge of the Lobster Lover, and it's published by the Acorn Press. She joins us on the line via Skype-to-Skype communications from Ontario. Hi, Hillary.
Hi there, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So now you're a writer in addition to being a broadcaster and a professor. Is writing something you've done for a while?
Writing is something I've done since I was 5 years old, and it's why I landed in radio quite by accident. I was looking for a job for a writer and landed up copywriting at CJFM at the time.
So,
made stabs over the years at writing various things, but this is the first time I sat down with the full intent of writing a novel based on my asking myself, what will you regret you never did? And there was only one answer.
People often say that everyone has a book inside of them. Do you believe that?
You know, I sort of do. It's whether they have the ability to get it out, because people's stories are amazing. People ask me, did you base your characters on anyone? And in the main, no. But I'm pulling so many stories from the lives, of, extraordinary stories from the lives of people I know to be background characters. It's just a question of, yes, you have to have some natural ability, I think, but you have to be willing to write every day, period.
Which came first for you, the story or the title? Because the title, Revenge of the Lobster Lover, is a rather unique one.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. But it tells the story of the book. It was early on, death of a lobster lover. And then once the book was finished, my daughter and I tossed it around. And she came up with Revenge of the Lobster Lover, which was a better title, much better title. But yeah, it was Death of the Lobster Lover from day one, practically.
So what is Revenge of the Lobster Lover about? I know it takes place in a fictional PEI village.
Yeah, kind of a maritime brigadoon and full of eccentric characters. I think in a way it's sort of a cozy, but it's a cozy noir because it has edge. There are some brutal scenes in it. What happens is that, you've got the old matriarch of the village who sews clues into her quilts. You've got the village cook, April Dewey, whose white cake is so heavenly it's actually killed a man. You've got Rose, the minister's wife, who almost didn't marry him because, obviously, his last name and her first. And a group of other people, into which comes a rabid, right-to-life lobster activist. And she has, at the beginning of lobster season, determined to end it. And she has a mysterious connection to a fellow who's just moved into the village, a millionaire, who's bought an A-frame that is precariously close to the edge of the cliff. There's a mystery that unites them, and it is that mystery that we find out in the story.
Quite an interesting cast of characters. Going back to something you said earlier, is this a situation where these might be some people you actually know?
One is Gus, the sort of, I sliced about 15 years off her age. She's actually 95 in reality. But Gus is the most like any real character who lives in a village that I summer in PEI, Seaview. The others, no, really not. Well, you know, some of physical characteristics maybe, but they just seem to be all there waiting to be released. And they keep getting up to things because I'm in my third book now. I've written the second. It's to be released in July. And I'm finishing the third at the moment in the series.
When you decided that you were going to write a novel, was this from a story that had always been gelling in the back of your mind for a while? Or was this a situation when you said, I'm going to write, and then the story came to you?
No, 10 years. It had been in my mind for 10 years. I was reading the Hamish Macbeth novels. They're mystery novels based in a little village in Scotland. And I read them over one winter on PEI, and I said, oh, this could so happen here. This could so happen here. And I wrote about 35 pages, and then not another word for almost 10 years.
And when you started writing, did you think, or when you restarted, did you think at the time that this was more than one book? These cast of characters?
It began to be more than one book partway through, and that's what happens with every book. Right now, as I'm coming to the end of the third one, the fourth one is already bubbling in my mind. I know how it begins. I know where I'm going with it. I think I know how the murder was done. So that happened even with the first.
Now, I understand you've won something called a bookie.
Yeah.
Which I'm assuming has nothing to do with gambling. Tell us what the bookie is all about.
The bookie is a new, actually, award put out by the CBC, actually the CBC Book Club, which is an online entity. And they called for nominations, and they shortlisted in 8 categories. They're genre categories, which the CBC, I think, has largely ignored in the past. They go for the literary works. But these were like historical and mystery and romance and all of that. And once the shortlist came out, then it was online voting. And over a week, and I was neck and neck with someone else, just what a stressful week. But I emerged successful, best mystery in the CBC Bookies, and I get a gold statuette of a beaver.
Now, writing is such a solitary profession, and just people who do anything in the creative world sometimes have some self-doubts. When winning something like a bookie, does it kind of solidify the thought, you know, I can do this, and I can find an audience, and my writing is good?
No. you go up and down. You have waves. You know, I think anybody who's doing anything thinks that the last thing they did, at some point they think, well, that was good. And then they think, no, you know, it wasn't so good. It could be better. And then they go on to the next thing. I think that's what the way creativity happens. You can't sort of sit and be, say, really satisfied. And I think Revenge of the Lobster Lover is a good, fun read. And a lot of people tell me that. And the people who tell me that actually count more for votes in my mind. Than winning a bookie award, although it's great. I'll take an award, especially a beaver.
In this country, it seems to be there are a lot of mystery writers per capita than some other places, and a lot of female mystery writers. Why do you think that is?
I know. I was going to kind of research that for a blog bit. That women have a propensity for fictional murder. Is there kind of some rage boiling in us? I don't know. I the other women I know writing mysteries, quite a few of them, they're into the humor of it. That my book is definitely not serious, except that it is kind of documenting the end of a way of life. Cozies do that. Villages are on their way out. I don't know. You're right. There's between 200 and 300 mystery writers in Canada. Most people couldn't name one. And a goodly number of them are women of a certain age.
Hmm. And I take it that writing is something, or writing books particularly, is something that you will now continue to do. You're working on your third, and I'm assuming you're not going to stop there.
No, I'm going to do a fourth, and they'll see what happens when I'm doing the fourth. I can imagine doing quite a few of these, and then before I'm too old, I do have a book that I really do want to write that I have about 60,000 words in. Now, these murder mysteries are about 90,000 words. So this other one, 60,000 words already, but we've only just begun to tell the story. So it's a big, fat historical based on PEI.
Wow. Have you ever thought, especially now that you've done three of these, have you ever thought of your characters coming to life either on the small or large screen?
Oh, yeah, it would be fun, but I know from the experience of others that basically what they want you to do is totally sign over your characters, totally sign them over, so you have no control on what they do with them. I mean, you know, that's speaking from the high ground. Nobody's offered me yet. I can be bought.
Well, currently you have complete control. The latest book, the first book, the first of many, is Revenge of the Lobster Lover. I thank you very, very much, Hillary, for taking the time to be on the program with us. I know people can check out your website at hillarymacleod.ca. That's MACLEOD.ca. I thank you very, very much for being on the program.
Okay, Peter. And can I just say, since so many listeners of yours are in the United States, that the book is being distributed by a small company in Maine, lovely company, called Island Port, one word, Press. And they, too, have a website on which Revenge of the Lobster Lover is featured with two main books. So I'm in really good company. And they can be ordered through there or Amazon.ca.
Excellent. So that's Island Port Press. Thank you very much, Hillary.
Thank you, Peter.
Hillary McLeod, author of Revenge of the Lobster Lover. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, click on the Stuff File program, and then the episode number for this show, which is show number 0080. And you'll find links to Hillary's website and to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones. It's no secret that obesity is a major concern in America. The weight loss industry has boomed as many of us search for ways to trim our waistlines. There's no shortage of ideas for how to lose weight, but a controversial group believes it has the answer that will finally make us all slimmer. What we really need, says the group, is more litigation. That's right, the group has just sued the U.S. government, saying that our federal agencies are not doing enough to promote a vegetarian lifestyle. What? The last time I checked, the federal government is regulating everything we eat and drink. The group says the federal regulators have a conflict of interest, but in whose best interest are all these regulations and lawsuits? Let's be fair, we don't need more lawsuits to help us lose weight. What we really need to do is follow the advice of one expert who summarizes the new dietary guidelines like this, and I quote, "Eat less and eat better," end of quote. That's great advice. Here's another thing we need less of, lawsuits like this. Learn more, go to our website at centerforamerica.org.
What are they saying about if the rains don't cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up?
If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, we do indeed have Stuart Nauman with another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Guess what?
What's that?
I joined the e-reader revolution.
Ah, congratulations. Congratulations. Which one did you get?
Well, I got as a birthday gift from my sister, brother-in-law, niece and nephew. I got a Kobo.
Ah, very nice. Very nice.
Yeah, 100 books already, the classics already downloaded. Plus, I downloaded a book of... myself, our friend Steve Leiva's second Fixer novel is now part of my Kobo network.
As you know, I am a Kindle evangelist now. I love the Kindle. Preach the Kindle. but I'm not against other people who have different readers. The idea is to read, period. So
exactly.
And you're enjoying it, I take it?
Yes, very much.
Excellent.
Very compact, actually.
Excellent, excellent. It's one of the things that actually screams you. I'm surprised you weren't one of the first ones with one. And on that note, what do you have for us this week in Book Banter?
Here's a book that could be you could download on your e-reader. Keith Richards' autobiography called Life, because on the front flap of the dust jacket to his best-selling memoir, he boldly states, "This is the life. Believe it or not, I haven't forgotten any of it." In fact, after you read this book, whether you previously knew about Richards' up-and-down life as lead guitarist for the Rolling Stones, you're surprised he is still alive to tell his story, let alone remember any of the details.
I think he's a science project. I think that's what he really is.
He's going to donate his brain to a medical institute when he's gone, or his whole body for that matter. Which is no surprise that many fans of Richards, the Stones, and the classic 1960s rock music eagerly anticipated the publication of this book. They wanted to get a rare first-hand account of what it was like to be part of the world's greatest rock and roll band, and for all intents and purposes, they have no reason to be disappointed. Richards opens up his memory bank and gives the fans what they want, and then some. This is an open, unabashed, and delightfully profane memoir of a life in rock music that only Keith Richards can tell through six decades that's filled with plenty of sex, booze, drugs, relationships, arrests, touring, and the creation of some of the best and most memorable rock music ever. And what Richards has to say will certainly fascinate and satisfy. We find out the real reason why the Rolling Stones was created, and we're surprised that the band was actually had its foundation in the blues, not rock and roll. We get privileged behind-the-scenes looks at the making of some of the Stones' greatest albums, like Exile on Main Street. And, of course, he recalls his on-again, off-again personal and professional relationship with the legendary lead singer Mick Jagger, which is liberally sprinkled throughout this book. Somehow through all the artistic disagreements and personality clashes, which Richards attributes to Jagger's tendency to an affliction that he labels as LVS, or lead vocalist syndrome.
not flattering, I take it.
No, I don't think so. But he does have a lot of respect for Jagger as well. So it's sort of like a love-hate kind of thing. But what is amazing about reading Life is Richards' vast knowledge and know-how of music, how a song is put together, and the mechanics of how it's played on guitar. Music experts will be amazed at how he dissects a song chord by chord, and even if you're not musically inclined, you'll be fascinated at how Richards so deftly presents himself as a rather brilliant musical mind.
Well, I was about to ask that. You know, sometimes you take it for granted when you see musical acts, especially if they're outlandish or outrageous or have a past or a history to them that is beyond just the music, you tend to forget that they can be very strongly musically inclined, not just somebody picking up a guitar.
No, exactly. And Richards really appreciates not only rock music, but the roots and the people behind it, whether well-known or not so well-known. You know, when I read this book, I found it to be a very honest, well-rounded self-portrait of one of the most talented, controversial rock musicians ever to pick up a guitar. And we're so glad that Keith Richards was able to remember every detail of it.
And the book is called?
It's called Life by Keith Richards, published by Little Brown, and it's $33.99.
Anything else you recommend in that vein for those who might want to read the Keith Richards book? Because now I'm sounding like the folks at Amazon with Kindle. If you've read this, you might like this.
Well, since you mentioned veins and Keith Richards, there's a couple of Rolling Stones related books that I recommend. First of all, I think one of the first behind the scenes books called Up and Down with the Rolling Stones by Tony Sanchez that was published in 1978. It gave the very first behind the scenes look at what it was like to be part of the Rolling Stones when they were traveling a lot during the 60s and 70s. It's a great book, actually. And also, the first member of the Rolling Stones to write a memoir, Bill Wyman, and his 1991 massive tome called Stone Alone. And one of the common threads between Stone Alone and Life is that they talk about how Brian Jones was a very talented man, but a very tragic figure who really self-destructed in front of the whole band by 1966. So it's a quite interesting book, and I think it's a companion read to Keith Richards' book Life, actually.
Excellent, sir. And people can find you?
Well, they can read me in the West End Times every week, but if you can get a hand on a copy of that, you could see me every week online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nelman and Book Banter here on The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we still have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but right now, more stuff right here. Lou Balducci of Mission Viejo, California, has brought to our attention the latest unusual Jesus sighting. He says he found what he believes to be the image of Jesus Christ in an old wooden rocking chair. The Jesus-like image can be seen in the flaking paint and rotting wood of the rocking chair that he had planned to throw away, though had never noticed the image in the 10 years he actually owned the rocking chair. The discovery led Balducci, who says he's not overly religious, to reevaluate his religious beliefs. Other friends and family members believe it's a blessing. Balducci's not sure what he's going to do with the chair, saying, "Right now, I'm enjoying having it in my home and showing it to friends and family." So, I guess now we can officially say, Jesus rocks. Okay, you know, making a bet with a buddy that involves shoplifting and running naked through the street is never a smart move. In Millville, New Jersey, authorities arrested 58-year-old Erwin Krakow, who confessed that after losing a bet, he had to choose between shoplifting $50 worth of merchandise from Walmart or running through the street naked. He chose Walmart, which resulted in him being charged with shoplifting. Now, in hindsight, Krakow told police he should have run naked instead because the fine would have been smaller. Ironically, even if he had not been arrested, he would have still come up short on the bet. He had stolen a USB card, two dinner spoons, a nutcracker, a decorative tree, and a few T-shirts. But the value of these items came to only $43.82, more than $6 short of his $50 goal. Damn, Walmart has some good deals, huh? Okay, while it's true that ex-lovers often resort to all kinds of vindictive actions when going through a divorce, this guy takes the prize. In Lorain, Ohio, a soon-to-be ex-stepdad sent a nude picture of his soon-to-be ex-wife to his soon-to-be ex-stepson. The text to the 15-year-old boy from the stepfather was accompanied by the message, "Here is your mom. How do you like this?" Wow. Let the therapy begin. You know, I don't think I'm really going out on a limb here when I say that this woman is probably better off without this clown of an ex in her life. Good riddance to bad rubbish. Okay, these days it seems choosing the right sensitive teeth, plaque eliminating, pro-whitening, tartar control, tropical mint explosion formula with baking soda and peroxide toothpaste has become just too darn confusing. An explosion of specialized pastes and gels brag about their powers to whiten teeth, reduce plaque, curb sensitivity, and fight gingivitis, sometimes all at the same time. Add in all the flavors and sizes, plus ever-rising prices, and picking a toothpaste turns into sensory overload. Manufacturers have finally acknowledged the problem and are putting the brakes on new product introductions. Last year, 69 new toothpastes hit store shelves, and believe it or not, that's down from 102 in 2007. Procter & Gamble, makers of Crest, say, it has significantly reduced the number of oral care products it makes worldwide in the past 2 years. Matt Doyle, Director of Global Oral Care Research and Development for P&G, says, "We've come to realize that fewer is better. You figure?" Okay. And while we're still on the topic of toiletries, in Newark, New Jersey, 43-year-old Eric Warren was just sentenced to 15 years for stealing $180 worth of deodorant from a drugstore. But before you run and cry foul, you might also like to know that this is Warren's 75th arrest, a record that the prosecutor says stretches back at least 23 years. Okay, so he's an extremely bad criminal because no one gets caught 75 times unless they're really bad at it. Anyway, he was convicted of the January 20th, 2010 robbery at a Rite Aid pharmacy during which he shoved $180 worth of deodorant down his pants. He's going to wish he had those while he's in jail, if you know what I'm saying. And if you're going to impersonate a police officer, better come up with something better than a barbecue fork as your weapon of choice. In Pompano Beach, Florida, 69-year-old Howard Schultz was standing out in the middle of the street waving the mini pitchfork at motorists and telling them he was a cop and to pull over. Amazingly, he was successful and some did actually do as they were told. One said he was scared for his life. The real police finally arrived and ordered Schultz to surrender his weapon and put him into handcuffs. He was charged with aggravated battery and impersonating, horribly I may add, a law enforcement officer. You know, that person was somebody who was pretty well close to being nominated idiot of the day in this edition of the Stuff File program, but he wasn't. However, this next person is idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Actually, it's people. Investigators in Orange County, Florida say robbers tried to distract law enforcement by calling in a false report of a carjacking. The two suspects, whose names have not been released, called 911 to report a couple was being carjacked at an area grocery store. The unnamed suspects had just pulled off an armed robbery at an apartment complex in another part of town. Officers didn't take too long to locate the suspect's vehicle, however, because when the robbers made the false police report, they gave a description of their own car. They were charged with armed robbery and making false reports. With criminals like that, who needs informants? Why would someone call in a phony carjacking and then give their own car as a description in that crime? One reason, and one reason only. They're idiots.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0080. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff again is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0080. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me as P.A. Holder on both Facebook and Twitter. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of... Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.